This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
The UK's digital tech scene is accelerating, and the proof is in the Unicorn Kingdom Pathfinder Awards. This year, we celebrate the next generation of pioneering startups that are shaping the tech landscape of tomorrow. The UK is a thriving ecosystem with access to global talent, cutting-edge research, and unparalleled investment opportunities. Your big idea belongs here. Visit great.gov.uk/UKPA to learn more.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm David Harper and coming up on this edition, the latest figures show that the UK economy grew rather unexpectedly by 0.1%. We'll look at whether it's a cause to celebrate for the government here. Could AI regulation be holding back development in Europe? We ask an executive at one of the big players in the industry. And Norwegian Airlines, despite a $19 billion loss in the last quarter, investors appear to be positive. I've been speaking to the company's chief executive. First, though, at this time yesterday on World Business Report, we talked about the Japanese carmaker Nissan, in particular a possible merger with Honda, which was looking less likely, and the rumours that the electronics manufacturer Foxconn was taking an interest. Well, today, this happened.
It is deeply disappointing that we were unable to reach an agreement on the deal. However, we were both able to see the potential of synergy with Nissan through this process, and we will try to maximize it on the strategic partnership agreed last August with Mitsubishi Motors.
Honda's chief executive, Toshihiro Mibe, confirming that the merger talks are now dead, and with it, the end to a tie-up which would have created the world's third largest automaker. Well, in the past few hours, Nissan has announced a drop in profits and cut its annual profit forecast. Dave Hodgetts was managing director of Honda UK until 2020, and I asked him why he thought it didn't work out.
Traditionally, they've been very big rivals for the number two spot in Japan in terms of domestic sales, etc. I think also automotive mergers in the past between similar large companies haven't proven to be that successful, to be honest. And I think they need a genuine synergy between the two companies to work. And by that, I mean that they need to be engaging in a large amount of technology sharing, what we call platform sharing, as in the chassis of the car and the designs of the car, and also their manufacturing methods and the way their factories operate.
You think they're just too different to companies to be able to merge their operations in that way?
I think we generally have a perception that, you know, Japanese car companies are all very, very competent and probably think the same way. In my experience of dealing with Honda for 30 years, that's not true at all. They all have very, very different philosophies and both cultures and also technologies that they use.
Also, from what we're looking at today, I mean, Honda's market value is considerably more than that of Nissan. But the talks, as we understand, were going into an almost equal role. Is it almost a case of Honda saying, well, look, you know, this isn't an equal partnership here?
It does sound like that from some of the reporting that I've seen over the last few days. You're right. So Honda value in terms of market cap is about 5 times that of Nissan. Although, to be fair, the sales of both companies globally are not that different. Honda has about 4 million global sales and Nissan about 3.4 million. So it's the valuations that are particularly different. And that probably goes towards the long-term feelings of shareholders about profitability, etc.
And finally, just to bring it back to Honda, you mentioned the potential for the impact of tariffs coming up. There are also, as we've discussed, the rise of the EV revolution, which is disrupting the auto industry. Are Honda going to be needing to look to tie in with another manufacturer now?
Yeah, Honda have always maintained a very fiercely independent approach for many, many years. Although in perhaps the last decade, they have realised the need to, again, share technologies and share development costs. In particular, they've had some collaborations with General Motors and quite a few other companies, such as recently Sony in Japan. So I think they are willing to do large technology sharing and collaboration with other companies in that sense. But I don't see Honda as a company that's voluntarily looking to actually merge with any other company. They're obviously fully aware of the difficulties they're going to have, as all car companies are, in competing over the next decade. But I think Honda, being a very, very independent-minded company, would probably prefer to stay independent.
Dave Hodgetts there, former Managing Director of Honda UK. Well, we have had a statement from Nissan, and they have said...
Going forward, Nissan and Honda will collaborate within the framework of a strategic partnership aimed at the era of intelligence and electrified vehicles, striving to create new value and maximise the corporate value of both companies.
Well, Marie Sarko is Professor of Management Studies at the Syed Business School and an expert on the Japanese auto industry. She told me about the difficulties that the two companies would have faced.
With Nissan and Honda, I think they had to become bigger so that they could possibly be number three in the ranking after Toyota and Volkswagen. But with the notion that it should be merger of two equals, shifting to a notion that Honda will be basically treating Nissan as a subsidiary, I think was the end of the talk. But I think we also need to understand that there were different corporate cultures. So at the risk of kind of caricaturing, Nissan is much more bureaucratic and slow in decision making, whereas Honda gives the impression that they are much more agile and creative. And those cultural differences must have got in the way.
Now, that's a really interesting point, isn't it? Because the speed at which the automotive industry is moving, especially as we look to embrace electric vehicles, that idea of being a bit slow to react and slow to make decisions, that's not a positive at the moment.
Absolutely, that's correct. And so Nissan, of course, you know, was a little bit of a latecomer in the electric vehicle market. If you remember, you know, with the alliance with Renault, they were doing pretty well in the 2000s, but they were very skeptical about hybrids. And they only really got into electric in the 2010s with its Nissan Leaf. And they also made a bit of a strategic mistake in thinking about affordable EV cars, which could be made in China, designed in China. So their exposure to China is much bigger at Nissan than by Toyota and other competitors.
Now, does that set the stage potentially for Chinese companies taking an interest in Nissan at the moment?
Absolutely. So one possible way forward is to have, this is publicly announced, I think Honghai, which is the parent company of Foxconn, showing an interest in basically buying Renault's share in the Nissan company. And that could basically lead to most of these several assembly plants, which are in China, owned by Nissan, some joint venture being handed over to the company Honghai.
But if you are a business, I mean, you mentioned Foxconn, that's a good example. If you are a business looking to make inroads into the automotive industry, Nissan carries a prestigious brand, which would certainly aid that.
That's right. So I think investors are, I'm sure, looking at this scenario, and many potential investors would be talking to Nissan in the coming weeks and month. But you know, private equity deals in particular have been primarily for now with tech companies, of course, Waymo and Tesla included. They're also present in M&A among component suppliers. But as you say, the brand name of Nissan is such an attractive thing for, you know, any kind of investor to get hold of. That must happen. This will be the number one.
So given that, where do you think the future of Nissan will be in 5-10 years' time?
So either it will be basically absorbed into a bigger entity, whether that's to do with incumbent like Honda, or else as part of a new entrant coming into the industry that has some kind of entry point, whether that's to do with a particular component capability like batteries or assembly capability, which is very important.
Marie Sarko from the Syed Business School speaking to us a little earlier. Now, moving on, despite the clever money predicting a drop, the UK economy unexpectedly grew by 0.1% in the fourth quarter of last year. It is, let's say, a modest boost for a relatively new Labour government, which has pinned all of its hopes on economic growth. It's not all celebrations, though. When you dig down into the figures, the picture remains difficult for the British economy. Today's GDP figures show an increase on the zero growth in the previous quarter, but it's still consistent with an economy that's struggling to gain momentum. Our business reporter Peter Ruddick is at the Port Street Bar, which is a pub in the centre of the city of Manchester in the north of England. And Peter, please tell me you have a strong economic reason for being in a pub this afternoon.
A very strong economic reason, absolutely. I'm not just here to sample the fantastic beers that are behind the bar. So many I can see there, all sorts of cask and draft, but I will be holding off until the end of my shift. I mean, you mentioned it, any growth is better than no growth, perhaps, but a lot of this is an expectation game. So because the analysts had thought there was going to be a bit of a slowdown, actually, this slight pickup in growth is good news. And I guess if you view growth as a three-pronged problem, today sort of solves one bit of the problem, if you like. So there's a political angle which has been solved because the government came in promising to grow the economy. If it had slowed down, that would have been an issue there. But the economic problem still exists. So we have an economy that is not predicted to grow very much, and that means that the finance minister here in the UK, the Chancellor Rachel Reeves, well, she might have to make some more difficult decisions on tax and spend. And then, of course, there's the real life impact of a not particularly strongly growing economy, and that has an impact on businesses in terms of their ability to expand and the money in our pockets. And that, I guess, is the reason why I've spent the day in Manchester here in the north of England talking to all sorts of businesses, because the argument has been that potentially the government's own policies have in the short term made it more difficult. I'm with Johnny, so he runs the Port Street Beer House here. He's also got several restaurants and bars across Manchester. A lot of my money, Johnny, has gone into your venues over the years. I've been talking about those figures towards the end of last year, so sort of October, November, December. It's a really crucial time for hospitality businesses in the UK. How was it for you?
Well, it was a fairly challenging time. We were down year on year over the Christmas period. It wasn't a stupendous Christmas by any reckoning. And the autumn was also pretty slow. So we've had some decent sales since, but they've been interspersed with some real low points over the last quarter.
So that headline of sort of a little bit of growth, but not much, sort of rings true. I mean, look, we know there's all sorts of challenges that hospitality business in particular have faced over the last few years. How do the current challenges compare, if you like?
Yeah, well, I think GDP growth is an interesting figure from an economics perspective, but I think the real key thing that I'm looking out for is that consumer confidence, and I think that is still at a very low ebb. It has been very much since the inflation crisis of the last couple of years. So people are still very wary about the pound in their pocket. And that has suppressed some of the spending, I think. I don't think some of the global factors have helped. I don't think the government's approach when they came in of being very downbeat and negative about the economy has really helped. And obviously, you know, nobody likes uncertainty, and there's a lot of that around in the world at the moment. So there's a lot of factors playing into what happens at the till.
I mean, you mentioned it. A lot of people are sort of saying, actually, it's not necessarily just about the policies, it's sort of vibes. And the government potentially being a bit of a vibe killer when they came in and sort of talking down the economy. There were some quite specific policies, though. I mentioned them in the budget around employer costs. Have they impacted you at all? Have they sort of changed your plans for the next year or so?
Well, I kind of look at this from both sides. From a political perspective, I understand, like, public services are in a desperate state. We need to raise some money. We need to raise more tax revenue. We need to invest in public services. I'm 100% on board with that. Whether the choice that Rachel Reeves made around national insurance is the right one remains to be seen. I can see how the thinking works. You know, they're trying to spur productivity. They want to drive an investment in infrastructure, in technology, in equipment, and make a leaner, more productive workforce. Well, that's my impression anyway. And that's very much something that we've been focused on anyway. That doesn't make it any easier to swallow because you can't just do that overnight. But yeah, it's going to be challenging, you know, because it's right through our entire pay grade. The change in the threshold is the biggest immediate impact that we feel. So we're talking £250,000 in additional costs in the next 12 months.
I mean, that's not insubstantial. We're in Manchester. For people who are listening, it's a growing city. There's lots going on. Fascinating, though, within the last week, one of the restaurants here gained a Michelin star. So that's two stars for the city. But also, a couple of more casual operators have said enough's enough. We're going to pull out and close altogether. How are you feeling about the next year, next 12 months?
Well, my default position is to stay positive and try and stay on the front foot, and that's what we've always done in our business. We've now been in business for 20 years in the hospitality industry in Manchester, so I feel very privileged to have lasted that long. But I do think that is about being progressive, trying to look forward, trying to read the runes of the customers and see what the lay of the land is. But it has been tough.
Johnny, thank you so much for having a chat to me and letting me come along and not yet sample the beers that I was mentioning on display. I said that growth is that sort of three-pronged problem and potentially one prong of it isn't solved. It is solved, but the other two aren't. And Johnny mentioning consumer confidence and consumer spending. Interestingly, of course, when you work out GDP per capita, so, you know, how our living standards have changed, that is the measure that still isn't growing. And that's the one the government's targeting, and that's the one that could mean consumers in the UK have more to spend. So perhaps that's where there's real room for improvement.
Peter, thank you very much. Peter Ruddick in the Port Street Bar in Manchester, while I sit here in the studio with a mug of instant coffee. I'm also joined by Susanna Streeter of Hargreaves Lansdown on the programme today. Hello to you, Susanna. Looking at the UK economy and those GDP figures, we've narrowly avoided a recession, but the next set of figures are going to be fairly critical.
Yes, absolutely. And it was a bit of a welcome surprise in today's economic snapshot and will give some relief to the government. But of course, what we're watching now is the upcoming data. And we've had a snapshot already. I mean, what you saw in December is you saw that uptick of 0.4%. And actually, the construction sector helped power that growth. But the latest data coming through from January, because, of course, today's overall picture is from December. Well, January doesn't look quite so good, for example, for the construction sector. So really, now we're looking ahead, and it's still going to be this pattern of stagflation, whereby inflation is still not back down to the bank's 2% target, and the economy is not powering ahead. It's only growing very slowly. However, there will be hopes in terms of consumer spending that with the national minimum wage going up as well in April, that will give more people that bit more money to spend, even though on the other side of the coin, companies are saying that they're going to be hit with higher wage bills because changes in the tax that they have to pay.
Susanna, thank you very much. A lot to pick over there. You are with World Business Report from the BBC World.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.
Service. Now, I'm willing to bet you are probably familiar with the online retailer Amazon. You've probably also heard of their streaming service and other consumer-facing businesses. What you might be less familiar with, though, is AWS, Amazon Web Services. AWS is a cloud services provider, and along with Google and Microsoft, it dominates the technology infrastructure which businesses use all over the world. Now, to put its size into perspective, it generated $107 billion of revenue in 2024, and it contributes the lion's share of Amazon's profits. And that infrastructure that they have has made it a major player in the AI field as well. Fresh from the European AI Summit in Paris, it's released a report calling for governments in Europe to help unlock the potential of AI technology. And that's something that's been echoed by the US Vice President J.D. Vance. He was speaking in Paris on Tuesday.
America wants to partner with all of you. And we want to embark on the AI revolution before us with a spirit of openness and collaboration. But to create that kind of trust, we need international regulatory regimes that fosters the creation of AI technology rather than strangles it. And we need our European friends in particular to look to this new frontier with optimism rather than trepidation.
Well, I've been speaking to Sasha Rubel, who is head of AI policy for Europe, the Middle East and Africa at Amazon Web Services. And I asked her if J.D. Vance is right and regulation could hold AI back in the EU.
One of the key findings of the report that we just launched, called Unlocking Europe's AI Potential, actually found that uncertainty around the EU AI Act, for example, is one of the key barriers to AI adoption. So 68% of businesses in Europe actually struggle to understand their responsibilities under the EU AI Act, and there's a large cost of regulatory compliance. So businesses actually estimate that 40% of their tech spend, so that means 40 euros out of every 100 euros, goes towards meeting regulatory compliance obligations. So this has concrete impacts on the adoption of AI, not only because companies that don't understand their obligations intend to invest up to 28% less in AI over the next 3 years, but it also really underlines the need for international alignment so that companies can really unlock not only the economic, but the social opportunities that this AI revolution represents. The EU has all of the ingredients necessary to continue to be competitive in the AI space. But this report that we recently launched actually highlights that some of the key blockers to adoption include not only questions around regulatory clarity, but also questions around funding and investment and skills. So larger businesses, what we found is that they're adopting AI, but their focus is actually on incremental gains. So largely around driving efficiencies and streamlining processes, rather than around innovation, like developing new products or disrupting industries. And so the task that we see ahead is really empowering larger enterprises to move from productivity and efficiency gains to operational and deep digital transformation.
I just want to take things back to regulation a little bit, because Eric Schmidt, the former chief executive of Google, has been speaking to BBC News today and has been giving a bit of a more pessimistic view of the future of AI. I can just play you a little bit of what he said.
I'm always worried about the Osama bin Laden scenario, where you have some truly evil person who takes over some aspect of our modern life and uses it to harm innocent people. What about rogue states? Think about North Korea or Iran, or even Russia, who have some evil goal, right? And this technology is fast enough for them to adopt that they could misuse it and do real harm.
Given how integral a platform like AWS is in enabling this AI technology, what sort of a role do you have in making sure it doesn't fall into the wrong hands?
One of the things that we were excited about to support in the framework of the AI Action Summit was the launch of the OECD reporting framework for the Hiroshima Code of Conduct. What that means in terms of everyday speak is that this was the launch of the first reporting framework where industry and the OECD came together and agreed on how to report back on innovations related to safety and risk mitigation in the framework of the development of advanced AI models.
As important as things like codes of conduct and information are, they don't really stop people from using the technology. How can people be blocked for using it for nefarious purposes?
So we have at AWS both an acceptable use policy and also a responsible use policy. And we have taken an approach to responsibility by design, where, for example, we have tools like guardrails for Amazon Bedrock that ensure that you can use these models in a way that is responsible and safe. We also were one of the first industry counterparts to implement watermarking for audiovisual generated generative AI content to make sure that we could be part of the solution and combating misinformation.
Sasha Rubel there from Amazon Web Services. Now, shares in the low-cost airline Norwegian are up slightly today, despite posting a net loss, surpassing expectations. It's also seen an increase in passenger numbers and revenue, although year-on-year the share price is down by more than 33%. I had a conversation with Norwegian Air's CEO, Geir Karlsson, looking at some of the issues facing the industry. But first, I asked why investors seem to be confident in the company.
We are seeing a stable and a quite positive booking momentum, especially from the second quarter this year. We have a higher load compared to the same period last year for the months to come, and also a stable and in some months an increasing yield, meaning an increasing ticket prices. So it looks quite good for the months to come.
Why do you think passenger numbers have increased?
Well, it's a combination of the fact that we have improved our products. We have increased the number of passengers. We are having a load factor in the between 80 and 90%, regardless of which month and you're looking at. So it is a combination of a good offering, good network, and also a growth in number of aircraft in the company. We have been striving to be very punctual, and over the last couple of years, we are among, let's say, the top five companies in Europe on on-time performance. And I think we are, have learned that the passengers, and not at least the corporate passengers, is really appreciating an on-time airline, and we are.
Norwegian used to operate quite a number of more long-haul routes and offer that same sort of service to longer, say, transatlantic flights. Is that something that you could return to?
That is not the plan for the time being, and it was an unfortunate decision that we felt that we had to take through the pandemic and the restructuring that we did in the company.
I just want to ask quickly about Boeing, because you operate a very new fleet supplied by Boeing, but Boeing have been hit by a number of issues from different directions. How is the relationship with Boeing?
The relationship with Boeing is really good. It has been not as good over the time, but as per today, it's good. It's also very nice to see that Boeing is now finally able to deliver aircraft to the industry, and not at least to Norwegian. So we have so far this year, meaning the last month, been taking delivery of three brand new 737 MAX 8 aircraft. So now we feel that we have more visibility from Boeing these days, and we are well prepared now for the peak season into the summer of 2025.
Have production delays by Boeing caused you problems?
Yes, it has, not at least in 2024, when we were supposed to get more aircraft, especially in towards the summer, which we didn't get. And to solve that, you know, we are normally then leasing in so-called wet leases from the market, which is really not something we would like to do. And it adds cost, it adds complexity. And very often it's not the same product as we are offering. So it has caused delays, it has caused issues. But it seems now that, you know, they have performing better producing aircraft.
We've been hearing a lot in the UK about the decision to add a third runway to Heathrow and increase capacity to the airport facilities in the country. How critical would a decision like that be to an airline like yours?
Well, first of all, we don't fly into Heathrow. We use Gatwick flying into London. And we have the same discussion in other places as well, also in Norway on the main airport here. So on Gatwick, the airport is full, but for us, it's really Gatwick that matters, at least for the time being.
But in terms of overall capacity, do you welcome a decision to add more space? Is this something which is a positive move in your view?
Not necessarily. It means that there will be more capacity potentially available as well, which will increase the competition. But in London, you know, we are focused on Gatwick.
Interesting way of looking at it. Guy Carlson, CEO of Norwegian Air. Susanna Streeter from Hargreaves Lansdown is still with us. Another, just very quickly, we've seen a drop in the share price of British American Tobacco, and a few reasons before this.
Yes, that's right. It's revealed a £6.2 billion hit from a long-running legal spat in Canada, but is also warned of significant headwinds in Bangladesh and Australia this year after the group missed its annual revenue target. So quite a few headwinds facing the group. I mean, the health risks associated with tobacco and smoking alternatives have certainly been under regulatory scrutiny, and this legal decision was looming, but shares really fell sharply today.
Susanna, thank you very much. Susanna Streeter from Hargreaves Lansdown joining us for World Business Report today. A reminder, you can always email us, world.business@bbc.co.uk. Great to hear your thoughts on any of these stories. But for now, that's it for us.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.